Thank you all so much for joining us this afternoon for this important conference call on the recent violence that has been coming from Gaza. Some background on this is on November 11th, Hamas terrorists killed IDF Lieutenant Colonel M during an Israeli covert operation, and this was the death of the first Israeli officer since Operation Protective Edge in 2014. And the next day, Israel experienced, in a period of only 24 hours, more than 460 rockets coming from the Gaza Strip, launched by terrorists. Many fell in open areas. About 100 of them were intercepted by the Iron Dome, but it did result in one Palestinian man being killed, more than 50 injured, and also terrorizing communities in Sderot and Ashkelon and other communities on the Gaza border. In response to the situation, the IDF struck more than 160 terror targets in Gaza, tunnels created by Hamas that were going to be used to infiltrate Israel to carry out attacks, and some military compounds. Thereafter, Egypt brokered a quote-unquote ceasefire with Hamas and Israel. And this conflict also led to a week of political chaos in the Israeli government. We are honored today to have Professor Ephraim Inbar join us from Jerusalem to discuss the implications of this recent round of violence in Gaza. Professor Ephraim Inbar is the president of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies. He's also the founding director of the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies, where he's been for 23 years, and he's a professor of political studies at Bar-Ilan University. He has been a visiting professor at Georgetown, Johns Hopkins, and Boston Universities, a visiting scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center, Manfred Warren NATO Fellow, and a visiting fellow at the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies. He was also previously the president of the Israel Association for International Studies and the chairman of National Security Curriculum Committee in the Ministry of Education. He's authored 5 books, and he is an expert on Israeli strategic doctrine, public opinion on national securities, U.S. Middle East policy, Israel-Turkey relations, and much more. We are honored to have you, Ephraim, today to join us. And with that, please take it away.
Okay. Shalom from Jerusalem to everybody. Thank you for the nice introduction. I'll start, with the end, and then I'll try to explain what happened. Basically, the perceptions in Gaza, as well as in Israel, are similar. And the perception, main perception, is that Hamas scored the victory, while we lost this round of violence between us and Gaza. The acceptance of the ceasefire was a victory for Hamas because they made no commitment to stop demonstrations in the near the fence. And indeed, last Friday, they had several demonstrations, which ended with some of the Gazans being wounded. The defense minister in Israel resigned, as you know. And this is a particular important event for Hamas, because Lieberman, before he became defense minister, promised to decapitate, the Hamas leadership, and he did not. There was a government crisis that ended with, the government surviving this event, and there were a lot of celebrations in Gaza. They gave out sweeties, burekas. It seems that there is not such a big humanitarian disaster as it's reported in the media, if they have this type of sweeties and goodies to share with the masses. In Israel, there were demonstrations against the government. Not only because what happened in the last days, but because there were 8 months of Hamas harassment. There were a lot of fires, a lot of people suffered in Israel, and the general feeling in Israel that the Israeli military response was rather feeble, and there was actually no deterrence, and because of what happened, probably we lost even more deterrence. I must say that, in my view, those perceptions are correct. And I'm not happy to say it, but in my business, I'm trying to tell the truth. So what happened? We have to understand the position of the Israeli government and also what this conflict constitutes. On one hand, we have Hamas, a Palestinian version of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is hostile. It wants to destroy the Jewish state. It enjoys killing Jews. But its most important goal is to continue to rule over Gaza. This is the only entity in the world where the Muslim Brotherhood is ruling nowadays. Their strategy against Israel is a strategy of attrition. Basically, they do not think that they can overcome the IDF. We have Israel has a strong army, but they try to make the life of Israelis bitter, hoping that this will weaken the Israeli society, and eventually Israel will crumble. This is also the position of the Iranians, by the way. And there is a pattern also to what they are doing, since they are under a blockade by Israel as well as by Egypt. Once in a while, particularly when they are in economic trouble, they try to blackmail Israel to get resources for Hamas, and they use force for doing so. It's a mafia-style strategy, which we understand. And they are practicing brinkmanship. They try to harm Israel, but not to provoke us into a too strong reaction. In contrast, Israel doesn't want to eradicate Hamas for simple reasons. Hamas, the existence of Hamas is strengthening the division between the West Bank and Gaza, and this is useful politically. It weakens the Palestinian national movement, and it actually proves to everybody that has open eyes that there is no real chance for a Palestinian state, because the Palestinian national movement does not meet the main criteria for a state, which is monopoly over use of force. The Palestinians have lost part of their territory to Hamas militias, and even in Gaza there is not only one military, there is no monopoly over use force in Gaza. It is of course Hamas, Islamic Jihad, there are other groups, clans with weapons trying to carve their own territory for economic and political reasons. So the existence of Hamas is useful to Israel, and we have to understand it. A second, Israeli consideration is, of course, that the Israeli government is not eager for a large ground offensive. It doesn't want to conquer Gaza. We don't want to be responsible for, a million and a half of additional Gazans, Arabs. It's because if we invade Gaza and take it over and try to suppress Hamas, will have to be responsible for the civilian population there. In addition, there is an understandable fear of casualties. Such a large encounter, military encounter, will bring about casualties. In the last encounter in 2014, so almost 150 Israeli casualties. So this is definitely a factor limiting Israel's freedom of action. And I must say that the fear of casualties is particularly strong at the elite level, at the leadership level, be it the military level and the political level. In my view, the Israeli society is not so much casualty sensitive as it is depicted. There is also a natural fear of international criticism, of taking Israel to the court in Hague, the international court. And maybe, I cannot prove it, although I have some feel about for it, I think that the IDF is Israeli military is not offensive enough. It's not inclined to take offensive measures. It is prefers to do the minimum, and some Western militaries at times display such characteristics. I must also say that the impact of Hamas attacks was quite limited. After all, what is affected is only the border area, and Israel is not interested in escalating the conflict because it wants it to be limited and doesn't want the conflict to expand to other parts of Israel. In 2014, the airport was hit, or close to the airport, and it stopped air traffic to Israel. So there are those considerations which are important. It may affect the flow of tourism to Israel. It may affect economic performance. So this is also a consideration that the government is taking. Another reason is that the Israeli government, rightly so, focuses on the north. We have a larger problem in the north. This is Iran. I think there is great consensus in Israel that Iran is main national security challenge for Israel, and it tries nowadays to establish an additional front along the Israeli-Syrian border. When the Syrian civil war is ending, and we have to prevent this development. The struggle with Iran is important, it's difficult. Iran is a much stronger rival, opponent, enemy than Hamas. And we don't want, or the government doesn't want to divert attention and forces in the Gaza sector. We don't want to be dragged into a lengthy conflict in the south when the most important challenge is in the north. Another reason for being timid is that Israel, because it has much better relations with Arab countries in the Gulf and elsewhere, is more sensitive to the Arab world. We've seen Netanyahu going to Amman. Yesterday, the president of Chad, a Muslim country in Africa, in North Africa, came to Israel. There are rumors about Israeli high-level visit to Bahrain, and I think that Israel is more sensitive to what might happen in the Arab world if we initiate a large-scale operation in Gaza. Some of those visits could be canceled, some of the contacts could be delayed. So in order not to prevent further progress in relations with the Arab world, Israel is careful with Gaza. Also, Netanyahu alluded to something else that he cannot tell, and he asked for the trust and patience of the Israeli public. I don't know what it is, and I'm willing to say that he's doing it not because of lack of courage, although he has never been trigger happy, but maybe there are some reasons for doing so. Having said that, I, if you read what I'm writing, I think that we could have done better by using larger force. And I want also to tell you that despite what it looks, Israel has a strategy vis-a-vis Gaza. It is not the offensive type that we came to know in 67. Victories a la 67 in Gaza is not possible. It is a patient strategy of attrition, what Israelis call mowing the grass. Basically, Israel understands that we live with Hamas. There is no solution. The people that think there is a clear solution, I think, are wrong. Not every situation in life has a clear solution. And what we are doing with the Gazans is basically trying to use once in a while large doses of force in order to restore lost deterrence and to try to exact a price from them that will keep the border quiet for a while. Not for long periods of time. This is what we call mowing the grass. And in my view, what is needed is greater doses of force in order to extend the period of quiet. And, you know, it's we are at war with Gaza. And the nature of war, to remind you, and this is what I teach in my classes, is to inflict pain. There are two equations we should remember in every war. One equation is about inflicting pain. And of course, the side that has greater power to inflict pain on the other side has a better chance to win. But there is another equation. And this is the equation that indicates the ability of each side to bear pain, to live with pain. And we know that Hamas doesn't care about the civilian population. And as a result of that, the ability of Hamas to bear pain is very large. And this is why they learn slowly. Collectives generally learn slowly. And we have examples. You know, Egypt took them, you know, 2 decades to learn that the conflict with Israel is too costly. The Germans needed 2 world wars to change and to become less bellicose. and to become what they are today, not very martial. I want also to point out that another difference between us and Gazans, we try our best to fight in a moral way. We have moral constraints, and we will not target civilians. And this is a real constraint, and we have to be aware of it. The good news are that the conflict is not over. We lost this round. Israel, you know, gave them hope because they are happy about this round. But Israel is strong enough to be able to lose one round. And hopefully, the next round, which may come very soon, will give us the chance to hit them harder and to inflict the pain that is needed in order for them not to harm us for a while. Now I'm ready to take questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Professor Inbar. I'd like to invite our listeners to ask questions by pressing star 6, and you will be added to the Q&A queue. I will ask you the first question. You briefly mentioned Iran, and I was wondering at this point, how much support is Iran still giving to Hamas, and is Israel concerned at all about a potential Iranian presence in Gaza?
The Iranians, first of all, have resumed the aid to Hamas. It was stopped for a while because they had differences over the crisis, the civil war in Syria. Now they are back trying to help Hamas, to provide them weapons, to train them. Also, they have another proxy there, which is Islamic Jihad, that is independent of Hamas, and it follows orders from Tehran. I don't think that we'll see anytime soon Iranian presence. This is not their modus operandi. What they are doing all over the Middle East is to build militias from people in the region that are being used to fight the wars of Iran. This is the Houthis in Yemen. This is the Afghanis in Syria. The Iranians are very economically, when it comes to their own blood. They are willing to shed the blood of Hezbollah, of Afghani militias, Houthi militias, Palestinian militias. So I don't think that we'll see a military presence in Gaza. Also, it will be dangerous for them because it's so close to Israel.
Great. Thank you so much, Professor. Our next question is from Sarah Stern. Sarah, are you there?
I'm here, yes.
Hello, Dr. Inbar. Always a pleasure to hear you. Excellent analysis. In your estimation, what would be a stronger response from Israel if you're concerned about sending in ground forces, a more prolonged air campaign, targeted assassinations? What would you recommend as a more forceful response without going to full-scale war.
Who was this? Who is
Dr. William Stern?
Excuse me?
Dr. Stern. Dr. Stern,
okay.
William Stern.
Okay. Well, I'm sure they are in the what we call the target bank of the IDF, fatter, you know, targets, bigger buildings in which, you know, Hamas operatives are living. There are more headquarters. There are more training stations. Actually, this time it was quite clear that we tried not to hit targets that were populated by Hamas people. We warned them in advance. We have this technique with a missile on the roof, and then they understand that they have to get away, and then we hit the building. And of course, they are using many times civilian buildings in which are civilian organizations. So this is one of the reasons that we are having this tactic. But there are also targets that are clearly Hamas without civilians. And we can attack, you know, in a pinpoint fashion those targets. I think also there are, you know, a lot of tunnels that can be hit. Also there is always a possibility of targeted killing, although the opportunities for target killing are not always evident because the leadership of Hamas understands that we are following them and it's very careful not to sleep same place, night after night. They are mobile, they are running away, they are on the run all the time. But I'm not sure that we should not conduct ground operations. We've seen this debauched clandestine intelligence operation. So it's quite, you know, we can get in. We know how to get in. I think that we can initiate some raids and risk even casualties in order to escalate our response. Not escalating our response, we pay a price for it. We pay a price in deterrence. So therefore, I think there is, in the ladder of the use of force, several areas which we can operate without being dragged into a large scale operation into Gaza.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question is from William Yeager. William?
Hi. This is not William, but thank you, Professor Inbar, for this very,
I hear a feminine voice.
Yes. my name is Elena, actually, not William. My question is about the Iron Dome. I've seen its effectiveness rate be quoted from like upwards of 90% to 10% by various military experts. It seems that during this incident, its success rate was on the lower side. So I'd be very interested, I would appreciate your thoughts on the Iron Dome and how you think it performed during this incident. Thank you so much.
I think that the Iron Dome was rather effective. After all, we suffered 5 to 6 hits, and they have launched over 500 missiles, most of them, or a large part of them, in areas, empty areas. But I think that we were successful in intercepting most of the missiles. They are trying to limit the effect of Iron Dome by saturation tactics, you know, shooting at once a lot of missiles. But still, the Iron Dome is a useful system, which actually allows, paradoxically, the Israeli government not to react in a more in a stronger fashion, because of course we are lucky there were no casualties in or very little casualties. So no, I think the Iron system is working, is working well, and the problem is we don't have enough Iron Dome batteries. This is a problem. We have we try to defend primarily strategic installations like ports, like power stations, airports, rather than the civilian population. I think that you know, people abroad do not always understand that the main purpose of Iron Dome is to allow the country to continue to function, but not to prevent at any cost, you know, casualties or civilian casualties. It sounds, you know, callous, but, you know, a power station is more important than civilians.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the caller whose phone number ends in 5660. 5660.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we do now. Thank you.
Oh, okay. I've enjoyed the discussion so far. Excellent. But I wanted to bring up an area which is perhaps more uncomfortable, which is the public relations of Israel are extremely poor. And you see, largely based on criticisms of Israel, particularly in the United States, the rising of anti-Semitism among the youth, the interest and support in Israel is dropping. It's dropping in the Democratic Party, and largely it is the public relations. Israel is taking a defensive mode. They say, we have to defend ourselves. For public relations, you have to delegitimize the other side, that the other side is bad. But there was no discussion of this. You see, around the world, the support of Israel, at least in the public relations, is weakening, and particularly in the United States. I see it myself. But that hasn't been discussed at all. Is that an indication of there's, you know, very little activity in it, and the approaches don't seem to be working? Do you have any comment on that?
Yes, I can say that, you know, the desire of Jews to be liked and to, you know, the convince the world what they are doing is right is a bit presumptuous. You know, first of all, we should remember historically, Jews were never liked in history, and this has not changed much in large parts of the world. So no PR campaign will improve, you know, our
but there are ways
status in certain countries, Arab countries or in European countries. Second,
and that's just not being done.
I think also in America, if you take a look at the polls don't show a sharp drop in the support for Israel. It's true that it's true a little bit in the Democratic Party. It is too much. It doesn't happen in the Republican Party. Certain young cohorts are, you know, less pro-Israel, but maybe they'll grow up. And, you know, I must say that if you take a look at the world and the relations with Israel, the world ignores much of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Sometimes they pay lip service, but the Israeli government in recent years was very successful in nourishing excellent relations with China, with India, you know, in those countries who didn't kill their God, but also with Arab countries. You know, the visit of Israel's prime minister to Oman shows it. The minister, the president of Chad, president of a Muslim country, came to Israel immediately after Gaza. So I think, you know, this desire for being liked, and there is a great exaggeration. And after all, Israel is a strong country. It has much to offer to the world. And I don't know if you are aware of that. There is a long waiting list for high state visits to Israel. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs cannot supply the demand of the world for high state visits to Israel. There is a long line. People stay in line to visit Israel. So I know that in the diaspora there is great sensitivity to what people say about Jews, but most of the world is realpolitik. We have something to offer, counterterrorism, water management, medical services, cyber, military equipment, military doctrine. And actually, the international situation of Israel is very good. Most countries ignore the Palestinian issue. Some of the press is, you know, very liberal, and this does not reflect the true situation of Israel in the world. We are, people run after us. They want things we have. And we have a great friend in the White House now. It's a big contrast to what was a few years ago. So I hear those complaints, and I think that there is an exaggeration in demand for being liked. So what if they don't like me? I'm strong, and people stay in line to get things from us. So I think that people, you know, Jews in diaspora, in contrast to Israelis, don't have this feeling of, you know, wow, we are doing very well. And, we have a problem with Palestinians, but this is something that we can manage.
Great. Thank you, Professor. Our next question comes from an anonymous caller. If you can just please identify yourself and ask your question.
Yes, my name is Linda Caro. Thank you for coming, Professor. I wonder if you're concerned at all with Iran paying Iraqi militias, and also how Turkey factors into the Gaza picture as they have taken control of the OIC. Thank you.
We are fighting the Iranian militias in Syria. Once we even targeted a militia on the border of Iraq-Syria. My institute does research on those issues, and this is of course of concern to Israel. Turkey is another important story. Turkey is a big country, 90 million people, a strong country in the Middle East, the largest military within NATO, with the exception of the United States, and in recent years it has adopted a very hostile position toward Israel. They try to lead the Muslim world. They their position toward Israel is partly due to the fact that the Arabs don't like Turks, and other Muslims are suspicious of Turkey, but Erdogan genuinely doesn't like Jews. He's an anti-Semite. He and his party is a Turkish version of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's a pity that this country has gone this way. However, I must say that Erdogan is also pragmatic. The economic relations between Israel and Turkey are not touched. They continue to grow. The Turkish Airlines fly, pay attention, at least 10 flights a day from Tel Aviv to Istanbul. It's actually a good airline that serves wine, despite the Muslim orientation of Turkey. But we are very concerned about Turkey. Turkey, in my view, Turkey enjoys the fact that Israel and Iran are at loggerheads because it wants to, just like Iran, to have hegemony in the Middle East, and it doesn't mind that the Iranians and the Israelis will fight each other and weaken each other, and hoping that they will be able to reap the fruits of this rivalry and emerge as the strongest power in the Middle East. Turkey is, I hope it will change, but I don't think it will change anytime soon.
Thank you, Professor. Our next question is from Brian Albert of the Endowment for Middle East Truth.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could weigh in on Education Minister Naftali Bennett's recent remarks that something to the effect of that he believes the IDF commanders have been hamstrung by military lawyers.
This is the feeling among many combat soldiers, including myself. Now we have at the regiment level a lawyer, and we have a very complicated system of approving targets for bombing, in which lawyers are intimately involved. So this is a clear limitation on part of our freedom of action. Having said that, and serving as a paratrooper for many years, I must say that those legal limitations are partly a result of our moral codes. To put it simply, combat soldiers, that their job is to kill the enemy, want to look the next morning in the mirror and be able to say themselves that they conducted themselves in an honorable manner. Jews, maybe we have, we are oversensitive to that, but we have a moral army, and I wanted to stay so. So we are not going to hit civilians intentionally, quite clearly. We put on ourselves greater constraints than any other army in the world. Part of us are dissatisfied, frustrated, but I think most Israelis feel good about being able to say that we behave in a most morally manner. We are not Russians in Chechnya. This is one of our self-imposed limitations. since we know this is a long conflict, a protracted conflict, it will not end anytime soon, I think it's very important for the army to maintain this code of conduct in order to be able to mobilize everybody, even the Israeli left, that is maybe more sensitive to those issues. So, yes, it is a problem, but it's a problem that I'm proud about.
Great. Thank you, Professor. I was actually just wondering if you could comment on the upcoming U.S. police plan. Ambassador David Friedman denied some reports today that there would be a delay in the rollout of the plan. What is the Israeli government perception, and what do we know, if anything at all, about this upcoming plan?
I don't think we know much. I don't think... you know, the Trump administration is characterized by being very transparent on this issue or on other issues. We don't believe that, you know, peace is around the corner. I think it is very naive on part of the American administration to think that they'll be able to offer, you know, a plan that will convince everybody to sit around the campfire and sing. This is not, you know, Messiah has not come yet to the Middle East. We are waiting, of course, if there will be a plan. Probably Israel's policy will be to say yes, but. And the Palestinians will say probably no, because that's what they've done so far, particularly with President Trump, and will be off the hook for a while. This is, you know, there is no chance whatsoever for any plan to bring peace at this stage between us and the Palestinians. They are not ready.
Excellent. Thank you. On that note, I just wanted to thank you, Professor Inbar, for joining us today and for all your insight. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I think Emmet is doing a great work, and it's my pleasure to be associated with you.
Thank you. And to all our listeners out there, thank you so much for joining our call today. We are pleased to offer these calls as complimentary, free of charge. And tomorrow is Giving Tuesday, so if you could please include Emmet in your giving, we would very much appreciate that. Our website is www.emmetonline.org, and you can click donate to support our cause and support our increasing work to improve the U.S. and Israeli national security interests. We wish you all a wonderful day and a wonderful week, and thank you very much.